This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello and welcome to episode 62 of the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. This is slightly different from the usual episodes as it was recorded in front of a live audience at Play Expo Blackpool in October 2018. Myself, Tom, and my regular podcast co-host Mike Phelan were lucky enough to take part in a live panel with YouTubers Adam Korolik and Daniel Ibbotson of Slopes Games Room, and the whole shebang was hosted by the Retro Hour UK. We had a little bit of a chat about our history with the Dreamcast and took some questions from the audience. I'm going to stop now, so please enjoy the entire panel.
If you only knew the power of the dark side.
2-1-0.
Hey there guys, welcome to the Dreamcast 20th anniversary panel. Yes, I am DJ Slope here from Slope's Game Room, and what we'll do is we'll introduce ourselves as we go down.
Yep, I'm Mike from Dreamcast Junkyard. I did the guide, which is all of the games for Dreamcast.
Hello,
I'm Tom from the Dreamcast Junkyard, as you can see. I am a Dreamcast fanboy, if I want a better word.
Hi, I'm Adam Korolik. I'm a YouTuber who used to talk a lot about the Dreamcast, and somehow that got me here. So, hi, nice to see you.
Okay, so what we're going to do, I think we're going to turn this primarily into a Q&A, but before we do, what we're going to do is discuss our why we think the Dreamcast is so important to us, and you know, a couple of personal memories before we hand it over to you guys to just ask away and we'll start.
I kind of want to discuss why you got the best microphone.
No, I've got the most booming voice.
Yeah, I'm just like, yes. I got to like eat the thing.
So, oh, but do you want to discuss why I've got the best microphone?
No.
We'll start with you, Adam.
I wasn't paying attention. What's the actual question?
Memories of Dreamcast. Why is it so important to you?
When that thing was coming out, like, you have to understand from the American perspective, the Sega Saturn to us was like not a thing. I mean, it existed, but we didn't really adopt it the same way. And so, to me, after the Genesis or Mega Drive was gone, Sega was gone. And then suddenly, a few years later, it was like, whoa, Sega's back. So it was like a weird nostalgia where my childhood was coming back through the Dreamcast. And I just kind of fell in love with it. That launch that we had, $99.99, which, a few days later for you guys, right?
Yeah, it was the 14th of October.
Yeah. Why would they do that? Like, $99.99, you guys should have done it too.
It was something to do with BT. It was something to do with the internet infrastructure wasn't ready or something like that.
So the 5 extra days help?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, anyway, so that launch was just powerful. It was just a lot of fun, and, you know, it just hit me as this, like, amazing video game console. And then the whole story with it, where it was so great, and it didn't fail like all these other bad consoles that had terrible games. It failed because the parent company, Sega, just ran out of money. So it went out at its prime, which is why I think it still has this big fan base that's like, yeah, where is the next Dreamcast game? Why is there no Dreamcast 2? I feel like that's, you know, just a big part of it, and so it hit me that way too.
It was a hugely successful launch as well. It was record-breaking.
Yeah, for a long time. I think it was until the Wii it was the most successful launch that had happened. And the only reason for that is because Sony didn't make enough PS2s. And, you know, the consoles after it, there just wasn't enough units. With Wii, there was, and then it surpassed it. But, yeah, for a few years, the Dreamcast had the most successful launch, and then sadly fell after that.
I think it was also the console that launched with the most amount of games on day one. Yeah. Talking about 30 titles.
Yeah, but that's because, I mean, I'm sure you know this, but because it had a whole extra year to just do that. Because the console came out in November of 98 in Japan, and that launch did not go well. Because they mostly had just, like, buggy, unfinished, or really, frankly, not very good games. So in North America and Europe, what they decided to do was like, let's just spend this whole year just making games. And then they came out of the gate hard with Sonic Adventure and Soul Calibur and Power Stone and all these like amazing titles like right at the go. As opposed to like a lot of other consoles, like PS2 had like, you know, like what was some of the, I can't even remember. Like a,
you always get your Ridge Racer in there or something. You always get your football win games in there.
Yeah.
It's an interesting point actually. You say there was a year between the Japanese and the rest of the world launch. And the way that they improved some of the games. One of the best examples of that, you can actually look at this yourself if you like, there's a game called Red Line Racer for the Dreamcast. It's a motorcycle racing game. If you look at the Japanese version and compare it to the North American and European versions, which is called Suzuki All-Star Racing, the difference is night and day. It's got the same tracks, but it's like almost like a PC version with the settings set down to the minimal, but on the European and the American version, it's like everything's been turned up to full. So that's a good sort of example of how they reworked certain games for the...
Yeah, Sonic Adventure, same thing. The Japanese version of Sonic Adventure, very buggy, very broken. Then they re-released it as Sonic Adventure International, which was just the American-European version, straight up. Because that was a common thing over there. And it's also another thing, they had a ton of re-releases over there. Sometimes for the better, like JoJo's Bizarre Adventure got a re-release that has VGA support.
Yeah.
Anyway, what was the question again?
Memories of the Dreamcast.
Oh, yeah,
we've covered the whole thing there.
We'll just spin it off into anything Dreamcast related.
So, yeah, memories for you guys for the Dreamcast.
Shall I go first, Mike? Or do you want something a bit to go next?
I think for me, I was a PC gamer when the Dreamcast came out, so I hadn't played a console for a year or so. And it's the middle ground between arcade gameplay and the sort of arcade thinking and the next generation of games, obviously, for someone like Shenmue. I think shows a new generation of games and it still has that classic arcade feel to it as well. So for me, it's sort of timeless console for that reason. I think when it came out as well, something like Soul Calibur, being a PC gamer at the time, Soul Calibur looked amazing, looked better than actually most games on the PC at that time. I think it was a stunning console and still is now.
Yeah, just going back to kind of history with the Dreamcast, I didn't actually own one. The first one I played was one of my friends. He got one of the Japanese original launch models that didn't have a modem on it, and that would have been sort of late 98, so I was already wowed by this thing. You know, I knew what the Dreamcast was, I'd seen it in magazines and things, but I didn't get my own until the European launch, which obviously was a year later. And I remember I had an N64 at the time, and I was desperately trying to sell it because my mum wouldn't let me have two consoles because she didn't see the need for me to have more than one games console. So I had to sell the N64 and then go and get my Dreamcast from Electronics Boutique in Manchester. And that's, you know, history was made on that day when I put the VMU in and turned it on. And here we are, what is it, 20 years later, sat at a panel talking about the Dreamcast, yeah.
There you go, never look back.
That's it, yeah.
Same for me, a little bit. I fell out of love with gaming a little bit, I suppose, just before the Dreamcast came around. I was hardcore Sega, as a lot of you know, like with the Master System, the Mega Drive. I jumped ship to the PlayStation when the Saturn era came about. And I was a hardcore fanboy, as a lot of youngsters were. Like, you know, get away with your Saturn, I was all about the PlayStation. But I always loved Sonic the Hedgehog. And when I remember seeing adverts for like Sonic R, I'm like, oh, actually, no, it doesn't look too bad. And then you play it, you're like, ooh, it's not that good. No, there is a Sonic 3D game for the Saturn. That looks... Oh, no, it's not. It's just Sonic 3D for the Mega Drive. So, I started falling out of love with gaming a little bit, and I got hardcore into DJing. And I remember seeing that the newsagents around us had these magazines that, you know, if they were a month old, they'd sell for 10p. So I just picked up this Saturn magazine for no other reason, just to look through it on the bus. And they had all these previews for the new Dreamcast that was coming out, and I'm finally seeing this new 3D Sonic game that I'd always imagined in my mind. I just couldn't believe it, to the point where I went out and bought more of these magazines for consoles I didn't have at the time, so that I could cut them out and make collages for school projects and everything. I was really into this idea of the Dreamcast, and when I finally got it, and this is where I just turned around again, do I buy another CDJ, which is a CD deck for DJing, or do I buy the Dreamcast? And I just jumped ship again, went to the Dreamcast, and like you say, I never looked back. I absolutely adore it. It's one of my all-time favourite systems.
So yeah.
And I suppose that's where we end there. So if anybody out in the crowd would like to ask questions for us, we are very much open to them. No hands are going up.
Well, it's been fun. Thank you. go for it. Sonic shirt.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Hi, guys. So I was just going to ask what you think about the homebrew and the kind of the games that are still coming out for the Dreamcast way after launch, and you know, kind of why that's so prevalent in the Dreamcast community where it's not on almost any other console.
Anyone specifically, or all of us?
Everyone, yeah.
Okay, you want to just go down the line? Anyone else there?
Yeah, I'll start. I think it's brilliant, frankly. The homebrew and indie scene obviously began just after the Dreamcast kind of went out of vogue as an actual living console. And the kind of the homebrew scene has grown to really be what keeps the Dreamcast current, I think, in this modern era. I mean, there are still games coming out today. There's games coming out in the next couple of months. It's just fantastic, you know. A lot of them do tend to be, originally they did tend to be kind of quite limited experiences, but they've kind of grown in scope now to the point where they're actually indistinguishable from actual retail games. You know, there's things that are coming into the Dreamcast now which are, you know, the ports from the PSP, for example, you know, probably 3D games. So yeah, I think it's keeping the community and the sort of the legend of the system alive, really, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's been consistently going since 2003. Mm-hmm. Feet of Fury was the first one ever. And pretty much every year since then, there's been at least one.
That's the Streets of Rage clone, isn't it?
No, that's the sequel to Streets of Rage. Feet of Fury is like a DDR clone.
Oh.
Yeah, so there's 48 now that were like press official releases. Mm-hmm. And it's really unique because obviously there's a lot of people like us who just love the Dreamcast and were like, you know, upset that it died. And the idea is with the Dreamcast, one of the things that killed it was the ability to play burned games. And I love that the irony is that's kind of the thing that's keeping it alive. Because it can read unsigned code. Its parent company, Sega, doesn't care if you make games for it. It's easy to develop for. And press discs are cheap. So people can go out and make their own games, bring them out to the Dreamcast, and we can continue to have new experiences. And then dudes like Josh Prod, who just love it. Josh Prod is a fascinating... It's a company, a publisher. This dude is weird. He's awesome. But he's going around like just buying up old games, like licenses. He's like, oh, my favorite game was Flashback, so I bought the rights to Flashback and I put it on Dreamcast.
And not to start with that game, he actually worked with the guy who actually created Flashback.
He told me the story. He was like, yeah, I really love the game. So I bought the game, not like copy, I bought the game, I own it, and I found the original developer, I paid him, like, bring it to Dreamcast, and he did it. And he's just going around with a bunch of his games, and he's even told me, he's like, if you're ever at a convention or something, and you see a game you really like, let me know, I'll buy the rights, we'll put it on Dreamcast. And I'm just like, I don't know where his money's coming from, but that's awesome. So
has he ever anything to do with the fact that Flashback's now come out on the Switch?
Yeah, because he owns it, so he's like, bring it
down. Well, that's where the money's coming from.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, he's doing that with a whole bunch of stuff. But historically speaking, the indie scene started with, you know, people like the Goat Games, the guys who did Feet of Fury, people who were passionate about Dreamcast and wanted to make new games, and they would make a game for the Dreamcast. And then eventually it moved into, like, people are making indies, like Orion Soft, that dude, he would make a bunch of games and put it on everything, but then he would also put out a Dreamcast version. And now you have Josh Prod, who's like, just bring everything to the Dreamcast. So it's really fascinating, the evolution of it, and that it's still around, I think, is amazing. And fun fact, the Dreamcast now gets more releases every year than the Wii U. Just put it out there.
Yeah, I remember, like, it was even almost like while the Dreamcast was really on its last legs. I remember, like, seeing on the PC that, like, you could download a new Streets of Rage version, a homemade game. I think it was a Beats of Rage. Beats of Rage. And I don't bother to download that. But then I saw that there was an ISO to be able to download it and put it on the Dreamcast. And now I'm really up for playing it. And I remember, from that point on, I actually remember someone had Sega Ages, and I was just collecting everything, even though it's not the greatest emulation. I was like, yeah, I want to get Sega Ages. And when he sent it to me, I realised it was a complete pirated thing, and it wasn't Sega Ages, it was just every single Mega Drive game on a disc for the Dreamcast. I don't know what have I bought here.
I think that's an interesting point you raise as well, Bill, just by coincidence, the fact that the Dreamcast is so versatile, the hardware is so versatile, the way that it can do things that a lot of the systems can do, but not as easily, such as emulation of other devices, you know. You've even got things like Linux running on Dreamcast, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
The thing you were talking about, that Beats of Rage, that's an interesting one, because Beats of Rage is, for anyone who doesn't know, is an engine that basically mimics Streets of Rage, hence the name Beats of Rage. But what's interesting and impressive about it is that you can actually take sprites from a lot of other different games. So you've got things like scrolling beat-em-ups with all the King of Fighters sprites in it, or the
Marvel characters,
Simpsons, Ninja Turtles, whatever you want to do. Yeah.
It's fascinating, yeah.
Well, it's funny, because you're talking about homebrew specifically. Yeah. I was talking about the independent, like, those are the ones you just burn, you make discs of independent stuff. Like, those guys are spending money to make those things in factories, on press discs, And like I said, there's at least, I think, 48 currently that have actually got releases that way. And then, of course, there's like a million of those things, which is people making their own game just for the fun of it.
It's interesting as well. There's kind of like a sort of a blurring between, I think, personally, between indie and homebrew on Dreamcast, because it's almost like a big kind of mishmash. Because basically, here's a story. Maybe last year, I think it was, somebody actually brought a version of Minecraft called Crafty, which was developed for Texas Instruments graphic calculators. Somebody ported that to the Dreamcast, and I found out about it, so I wrote an article about it on the Dreamcast Junkyard, and I actually created, I went online and typed into Google, font generator or something, looked for a Minecraft generator for the font, created this logo, and then a couple of weeks later I saw somebody selling a box copy of Crafty on the Dreamcast with my logo that I created and the artwork from my article. So I was just like, that's weird, but you know, I'm happy to contribute to the continuing cycle of Dreamcast.
Yeah, but see, that's just a burned game at that point. Yeah. As soon as somebody's like, you know what, I have permission, I'm going to build this in a factory, usually in Germany for some reason, and then they press them there, and then boom, sell them around the world. You can't do that with
Crafty. That is the only bad thing by the indie scene, really, because there's lots of games on, particularly on eBay, where you'll get copies of Neo Geo shooters, which just use Neo Geo emulator, and then they burn a copy, just press a copy onto a CD. I think with Josh Pod now, obviously with having the right slots of ISCO games, it's interesting to see that we've actually got an independent scene which is actually proper games, rather than just someone making games like QCast did or like NG Dev Team did.
Yeah, for those not familiar, like I said, Josh Pod, weird guy, he's doing what he said. So ISCO is a company that made a bunch of Neo Geo stuff, and Josh Pod's like, I really like your games, I want to put them on Dreamcast. And so he went to them, and the most official way he could, ported them over to Dreamcast using like legal emulation with their consent. That's another line, man. Like the fact that he's like, I'm not just pirating it. Like we're gonna pay, money's gonna be traded, game's coming out.
It's all about building up those relationships, for that, isn't it? Definitely. Yeah. I remember when I was creating my Space Channel 5 video. There was a section where during like an interlude section, I wanted to play around and just get some footage of some of the VMU stuff, and I noticed that there's a whole like homebrew scene with VMUs as well. Like the people actually make games to put on the VMUs, not just the Dreamcast. Is that the VMUs? Obviously, everyone knows what they are. But yeah, they're those little memory cards inside the Dreamcast controller with the little mini screen. Do you know much about that?
Yeah. There's a guy. His name is Falko Gerges. You might know him from. He's created a game that was on Kickstarter called Elysian Shadows, which is in sort of endless development hell. As a side project, he's working on this thing which allows you to create homebrew games and graphics for the VMU, and I've seen it in action, and it's pretty impressive. There's even like a 3D engine on it and everything, like, it's really, really cool.
And we have Flappy Bird.
Oh, we did, yeah, Flappy Bird on the VMU, yeah, that's a treat for the eyes and thumbs.
So it was one of my biggest mistakes, actually, because I really got the idea, oh my god, imagine if I had four of these VMUs with four controllers, and obviously back then the controllers were like, what, 25, 30 quid each, and the VMUs weren't much cheaper. So I remember selling my entire Mega Drive collection for £1 a pop, just so I can get a third and fourth controller, just so I could almost write my name, because I've got five letters. The biggest mistake of my life.
Yeah, this just going back to the VMU again, the guy that's working on the VMU software is actually working on an actual homebrew game that involves you using two VMUs to like play against each other. So
I've seen this.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, it's not very far along yet, but it's...
I'm just proud by it. Done.
Yeah.
So yeah, we answered your question and a lot more. Anybody else got any questions?
The Dreamcast has amazing accessories. Which ones are your kind of favourite, and are there new accessories coming out for the Dreamcast?
That's the question.
It is. The last new one I remember was, it came with Alice Dreams Tournament, that little flashlight thing you would put in the controller.
Yeah,
the 3D printed one. It didn't really have much of a purpose. It was like this little thing you put in the back of the controller, and it would have a reading light type of thing that would go over the VMU. But it wasn't powered by the Dreamcast. You had to put batteries in it. So that's the last one I remember that was...
Before that would have been the bootleg Dream Power Power.
Yeah, that thing's fun.
You got something that you can dance inside. Yeah.
That is the hardest.
What is that? I don't know. What is that?
Okay, so I was about to say, that's the hardest independent game to get, by the way. It came out only in Hong Kong, and it's this Dreamcast disc that's basically like a weird kind of DDR clone. But it came with this special controller that you have to like wave your hands over.
It's not Power Device.
Yes. Yeah. There is a Dreamcast version that only came out in Hong Kong through completely illegitimate means. And it's a very hard one to find. But yeah, I think you're right. Prior to that would be the last accessory that came out.
There's so much more out on the floor. I mean, you've got the Dreamcast TV, which is...
Oh, the diapers.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a slight surprise. There's the karaoke machine. Trying to play any game that isn't a fishing game with the fishing rod is always fun. Especially Soul Calibur, that's great.
I'm trying to think about the favourite one, though, is because most of them, to be honest, I didn't really have much of a practical use for it.
I remember I went to Poundland. Poundland.
I know what it is.
This
is my second time in the UK this year.
Pretty much the death of the Dreamcast. They were selling, I don't know how they got them, but just boxes and boxes and boxes of Dreamcast keyboards.
Yes, I remember that.
So I bought 20 Dreamcast keyboards. And I'm like, I don't know why I got this. Maybe I'll sell some and they'll go for like 50p. I'm like, I don't know what we're doing with these Dreamcast keyboards. And I start giving them out to my friends, like, Dan, stop giving me Dreamcast keyboards.
And I think there's so many peripherals and add-ons for the Dreamcast that, you know, everyone knows about the light guns and everybody knows about the karaoke machine and the maracas and that kind of thing. But there's lots of interesting ones that maybe don't get as much, airtime, if that's the right word. There's things like, there's a lot of unreleased stuff that, you know, comes to the fore every now and then, you know, if you dig through the archives of Dreamcast stuff. One of the most interesting ones that I know of was a system that they use in Japan for connecting the Dreamcast to the telephone network. So it would use almost like a mobile phone signal to connect to this like sort of small area network that was connected to the side of buildings, like a satellite kind of dish.
Not really Wi-Fi thing.
Kinda, it was only released as a prototype. It was never actually launched. That's a really interesting little device for the Dreamcast. Yeah.
One that I think is fascinating. It could have changed everything. There are pictures of it. There was a VMU looking type of thing Sega made that was actually an MP3 player right before iPods came out. So had that come out, who knows? Like, they could have been pumping money into that console for completely different reasons.
Yeah, and
same with the DVD player.
I'm just on that note, there's things like the Sega Swatch. I'm sure people are familiar with that. That was a partnership with Swatch, the watchmaker, where they were creating these sort of wireless-enabled watches for the Dreamcast. You've got this thing that would fit into the controller. It looked, was like a satellite dish. You would hold it near to the satellite, and you could transfer data between the watch and the Dreamcast, and then you could take your watch, save data, so like maybe like a local arcade or something, and then download your data from that onto an arcade machine. So there's so many interesting things.
Yeah, a lot of really cool concepts, but I think the most practical one these days, maybe, like the broadband adapter, because that's the one that gets the most mileage, I think.
And DreamPi as well. We've got DreamPi.
I think we're thinking like officially licensed stuff, right? If not, that's fine. you're right, that is a practical way to get online now, but if we're talking about stuff that actually came out, I probably would say that. But if we're going like newer stuff, maybe the GDMU.
Yeah,
that's pretty nice.
What's this?
The GDMU. You know, like the Ever Drives?
Yes.
Think of Dreamcast version.
Okay.
You take the Dreamcast, you take the laser assembly out, and you put in this little board, SD card, games.
Yeah, so someone sent one over there.
Yeah, they're pretty neat.
Yeah. And then you got the, is it sort of Sega's version of the iToy? There's like a camera.
The DreamEye.
Yeah, DreamEye, yeah. I mean, that thing is pretty awesome.
It's a digital camera from 2000, and it acts like it, but it's
cool. Any games?
Huh?
Does it work with any games?
I think it just came with it just worked with the software that it came with.
You've got like a very basic version of like Photo Editor, which has got elements of Adobe Photoshop from the early 2000s.
Right.
It's not great. But
yeah, I don't remember any games specifically using it, and if they did, they would be Japanese. Because it wasn't released outside of Japan.
No, it was basically used for, they had a web conferencing function as well that they kind of marketed to the Japanese audience that, you know, you could have one of these things in your house. It would be not just a games machine, it would be like your whole kind of communications device. So it's interesting that Sega Japan would kind of market in the Dreamcast, not just as a games machine, but also something that you could telecall your friends, and you could do stocks and shares on it. You know, you could order the groceries on it. It was like a device for everything.
Yeah.
For games.
We have a unique opportunity to talk about one of those things. So the Divers 2000 Dreamcast that he mentioned, it's a big blue TV looking thing, which there is actually one here. Which
is an incredible way of
it. There's like 200 of them ever produced. I've got one, and that's the only other one I've ever seen. And the cool thing about that is the idea behind it was that they were like, all right, we're going to release these. And the idea is people will buy tons of them and put them all over their homes because it came with the camera, it came with a keyboard, it came with, of course, itself as a TV and a Dreamcast, has a built-in modem. And the idea was that you would place them all over your house and you would have, it was essentially like a physical edition of Skype.
that was supposed to be in your house that, of course, everyone in Japan was going to have. Well, that doesn't work if you only make 200 of the things for the whole country. But the idea is that there was something to that. They were thinking this was going to be like a big networking device. So I invite you to go take a look at that thing, because you'll probably never see one again, because it's such a weird oddity in the Dreamcast library.
One thing I want to mention, going back to the broadband, I remember like the broadband adapter. Obviously, you had the smaller modem. What was it, the speed on the...
The 56. There was a 22, right, like early on?
The
22.
So it was when Quake 3 Arena came out, and a lot of the people in my village that were obsessed with it ended up trying to get that modem, simply because by this point that they actually gave it so that it was cross-platform play, where you play Quake 3 Arena with the PC players. And I interviewed Scott Hawkins, the guy who was basically behind that, and he also made Save the Swell, that free game that you got with the magazine and a couple of browser discs. And he said that for one point, for, I don't know, like a month or so, he actually got employed. His job at Sega. His job at Sega was simply to just sit there, because he was such a good Quake 3 Arena player, and just fight off the PC players when they went and attacked the Dreamcast players, because the Dreamcast players just didn't have a chance playing Quake 3 against the PC. That was his job. For about a month, just to sit there, play badly, wait for the PC players to come along, just destroy them, and let the Dreamcast players just have a little play on their own. That was his job. So, any other questions?
Hi, I've been through a few Dreamcast consoles now. My original childhood one, the laser died in it, and I know there's options like SD card mods and that now, but part of the experience to me is the sound of it screaming at me. Do you guys have any advice or do anything in particular to try and like prolong the life of the lasers in your Dreamcasts at all?
A few suggestions. Clean it from time to time. Do not play burned games.
Does that affect it?
Yeah,
it can affect the speed.
Because at least with a lot of the older rips, you're compressing a lot of the data, and the console was never really meant to read games that way. So it has to do a lot of moving back and forth that it wasn't meant to do, which can just wipe out the motor.
On top of that, I mean, there are some burned games that I put into my console, and when they spin up, it's been hard.
Sounds like it's taken off.
You get high pitch, like whistling noises, and it doesn't sound good.
Yeah, don't play burn games. That's number one. Like I said, just clean it from time to time. But beyond that, the thing is, the problem with the Dreamcast is if it has a flaw, that's its Achilles heel. Is the lens on that thing just wasn't as well built, and it turns out the reason for that is because they overdid it on the Saturn. Because the Saturn lasers are built really well, so when they were trying to cheap down, that was the place where they did it.
I've also seen a current trend of people using like silicone grease to grease the gears inside the GD-ROM. I personally have done that because I quite like the sound of my Dreamcast sound like it's going to take off. But you know, you might want to get that as well if you can be bothered. That is.
Just buy another Dreamcast. Not that expensive. Any other questions?
This is for all of you. What's your favourite Dreamcast soundtrack?
Ooh, good Shenmue.
I think that was the most predictable answer ever, but still, it's true.
I'm going to counter that and say my favourite soundtrack is Headhunter. The soundtrack was done by Richard Jacks, the guy who did the soundtrack for MSR. And I don't think, well, for me at least, there's no soundtrack in any of the Dreamcast games that's as orchestral and as rousing as that. It sounds amazing. It sounds like something you'd get in a movie, you know. So yeah, take that.
Shot. No. Head Up is a cool game. It was exclusive to Europe.
Oh, exclusive, right? Yeah.
Yeah, we never got it, and neither did Japan. So congratulations.
I think for me, Chris Tactic. Bit 1990s.
The 360 re-release.
Yeah.
Did you play it?
I did play it.
Because they took the score off. Yeah. It was all Offspring, and they were like, "Oh, we've done that. We don't have the rest of that anymore."
If you don't have Offspring about religion, it's not Chris Tactic. It's a lot of Dreamcast games actually very similar, like Space Channel 5, and a lot of games on Dreamcast are very sound focused. The sound was really sort of part of the experience. So Chris Tactic is a fantastic soundtrack.
He's only got like three tracks during the whole game, hasn't it?
Yeah.
One extra.
Yeah.
When I went to saw Off Screen recently, they said people with Crazy Taxi t-shirts. It's amazing. Crazy Taxi is an obvious one, but that's obviously licensed music. I would say Space Channel 5, but that's also a little bit licensed.
Can we talk about ones we hate?
No, I love them.
I'm not going to talk about soundtracks we absolutely hate.
If you want to, maybe you want
to. I've been sat listening to 18 Wheeler, the background music, for about 6 hours yesterday. I hate that game and I hate that song.
It's just kind of the zombie. It's kind of okay in an arcade, but outside of that, I'm like, you didn't need to. You could have put Propeller Arena out instead. You didn't have to put this out.
I was afflicted, so.
And it's got a sequel as well. I recently found that out.
18 Wheeler? Yeah, there's a PS2 sequel. King of 66 or something.
No, probably, my favourite would probably be Sonic Adventure. Yeah,
that is good. Any cheesy,
absolutely cheesy Crush 40 stuff.
Same with Sonic Adventure 2.
I think it's worth mentioning the indie games as well. A lot of the indie games have got some fantastic soundtracks, sort of Euro trance, like techno soundtracks. All the WhoCast ones, that's some fantastic ones. I'm not quite sure who did the soundtracks for them. There's one guy in particular, I can't remember who it was.
I can't remember, but are you going to mention Hermes, the homebrew?
There's
an old game called Hermes, which was released about 6 months ago, maybe?
Yeah. It was over a year ago.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe over a year ago then, okay, sorry. It's made by a software house called Retro Guru, and it's like an Amiga-ish style kind of side-scrolling platformer. And the soundtrack is just incredible. It's like a really high tempo
tune.
But it's really memorable. You can put it in your CD. I put it in the car in the CD player.
I was going to bring that up. Well, circling back around to the indies thing, one thing that's really cool about the indies is they're doing stuff with the Dreamcast that Sega never did. So, like he pointed out, a lot of the indie games, the bonus feature is, the entire thing is also a music CD. Put that anywhere you can listen to it. And a lot of them, like that one specifically, you pop that in your computer, it's got like 10 other versions of how to play it. It's like, okay, there's the PC build, there's the Amiga build, there's the Wii build if you want to take the time to do that. It's got this, it's got that. It's like, dude, that's amazing. And was it Escape 2042?
Yes.
That one is so weird. Orion Soft made this game. He made it for Mega Drive and Genesis, and he made it for Dreamcast. However, if you take the Mega Drive Genesis version, put it in your console, and you take the Dreamcast version, you put it in your Sega CD, or Mega CD, it will use the Dreamcast disc as audio for the Mega Drive version. It's like three Sega consoles working together to produce one game. It's really cool.
I like the Ghostblade soundtrack.
I picked that up on PlayAsia for the PlayStation 4 release, and that comes with a CD of the soundtrack. It's incredible. It's so good.
Rush Rush Rally Racing. Mm-hmm. I like the music on that one.
Absolutely. And also, I don't want to ask a question here, but it sort of relates to this a little bit. I know when you put your Dreamcast CDs into a CD player, you have that female voice that this is a Dreamcast disc. It must be used on a Dreamcast unit. I recently found out if you put C-Man into the CD player, it has a completely different... It's basically C-Man telling you you're going to get a virus if you keep playing it on your CD player. Do you know any others that do that?
Not offhand, no.
I'm trying to think. There are obviously there's different voiceover for different
regions
right, so you get different ones for Japanese games, different ones for American games. I'm trying to think if there's any really cool kind of hidden Easter eggs, but
I'm sure they exist, but yeah, I don't know of any offhand.
I think I should try and seek out that woman who does the voiceover for the English version of the warning thing. For those of people who don't know, I went on this mad escapade a couple of years ago trying to find the guy who was in the adverts for the Dreamcast.
The barber one. Yeah.
I eventually found him after maybe 9 months of searching, and it was just really bizarre. But I decided to go on the next quest, which would be to find the woman who did the voiceover on the Dreamcast disc. Really just to ask her to maybe say it over the phone to me. I don't know, but I'm drawing a blank, so if anybody who's here today knows who she is, let me know.
So, yeah, any other questions?
It would have been really great if some woman in the back just raised her hand. She's like,
it's I've me. Been waiting to be known. All
right, this is a question to all of you. Do you know of any software or games that use the WinCE system on the Dreamcast?
I know there's a couple that actually use it just to boot. I know that Sega Rally 2 uses it.
Is that the Windows CE stuff?
Yeah, I know that.
There's Resident Evil 2.
And what's it called? Jimmy White's
World. Yeah, exclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few, but they're not super common. The whole idea was that the Dreamcast was compatible with Windows CE to help make it easier to develop games for.
But yeah, not too many utilized it. The only one I can think of offhand is Resident Evil 2, although probably Resident Evil 3, I would imagine.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, somebody, please, but I think Street Invaders, which is a point-and-click adventure game, also uses Windows CE, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
I think some early Japanese games as well.
Oh, I'm sure there are, yeah.
Well, was that Planet Ring did?
Maybe not.
Planet Ring?
That was also a past game.
Which
is back online now.
It is.
Yeah, so... Side story, Planet Ring was a game only you guys got, congrats, and it was a completely online-dependent game, but as soon as Sega shut down servers, it was a coaster. Like, you turn it on, it would say, I can't see anything, goes down. But fans, dedicated as they are, back online, congrats.
Essentially just four minigames, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I just kind of never got the chance to play it.
Okay. Yeah. Any other questions? Hello. So, if the Dreamcast had survived enough to be able to evolve, very much like the PS2, 3, 4, where would we be now?
Well, good question.
Dreamcast 1.
Just on that topic, though, about a system evolving, apparently Sega's original plan for the Dreamcast was for it to be a console that would come out in waves, so it would be a version 1.1, 1.2, increased specifications, and I think the modular way that the console was built is a reflection of that. I don't think they ever envisioned that it was be a box that was static. I think that there would have been improved versions had it survived. But sorry, Adam.
I'm just holding the mic. It doesn't mean anything.
Is that similar to how that PS4 goes to PS4 Pro and this sort of thing, or are you talking about that?
Yeah, there's an interesting interview in there. There was a magazine called Total Control that existed around the time of the Dreamcast. And it's one of my favourite magazines because even though it's a multi-format magazine, it was heavily it promoted the Dreamcast, so there's a lot of Dreamcast content in it. There's an interview.
I take back what I said about you having a good mic.
There's an interview in that magazine, I can't remember which issue it is now, with somebody from Sega who actually said, on record that was the plan for the Dreamcast. It wasn't meant to be a static console, it's going to be upgradable. But I do think that. So is it me talking too close?
I doubt it.
I think if the Dreamcast had survived, then there's every chance we would have seen, a successor to that system, and maybe we'd be playing Dreamcast, or maybe not Dreamcast, but certainly Sega.
I don't think it'd be called Dreamcast. I think that's one of the things which...
That's one thing I love about Sega. They didn't just keep using a name over and over again. Like, when it came...
Finish your point, sorry. Well, that was it, really. There's fact, I think a lot of people say about Dreamcast 2, we get a lot of people talking about Dreamcast 2 to us, and it doesn't fit Sega's model really to have Dreamcast 2. Dreamcast 2 would be the upgraded Dreamcast, so I think it would be some other form of Sega console. I don't think there's any reason why Sega couldn't make a games console now, but I think they would have to make a massive, obviously, apart from the financial side of things, I think they would make a massive change in their sort of way of going. As I said, the Dreamcast is the arcade game sort of made Dreamcast. I don't think it would have floated now. I don't think we could have a console just based on that kind of game anymore.
Anybody else?
Just leading on from that, guys, about the arcade experience, what if, before Sega's demise, what Sega arcade game would you have liked to have seen released on the Dreamcast?
Ooh.
Star Wars Trilogy.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Star Wars Trilogy was based on Model 3. So it would have been compatible with the Naomi Adler. And I know that because
can it be any Sega arcade game, or does it have to be like that era?
I mean, I was always upset that Monkey Ball never made it.
Monkey Ball would have been good, because the reason I say that is The Lost World, Jurassic Park, that arcade game, I would have loved to see that, but it would have been more appropriate on Saturn.
I would have liked to see things like Outrun 2, eventually went to the Xbox, and things like Afterburner.
Scud Racer,
fantastic. So yeah, there's a lot. You just have to look at the Xbox, really. Look at the arcade conversion on the Xbox.
But this is something I've always had a little trouble with Sega. Now looking back retrospectively, I think it might be one of the reasons that people didn't like the Dreamcast as much. You're going to completely tell me I'm wrong, but please do.
You're wrong.
So basically, I look back and one of my favourite games of all time is Crazy Taxi. That game is a 4-minute game on loop, and there's nothing extra to that game whatsoever. And in this day and age, that game would be a £10 game if it was a brand new game. Absolutely bare none. That is not a £40 game by today's standards, and it's the case with a lot of the games coming out for it, because obviously Sega are primarily, a lot of the stuff they did was port arcade games, and that's what arcade games are, you know, 18 Wheeler Trucker and all these other games, and they just don't work in this new day and age. So I think they would have to heavily change. I mean, obviously there's, you know, differences with that, you know, when you look at things like Phantasy Star Online and stuff. But I mean, if they did continue the way they are, the games that they would put on their new Sega system nowadays would be very different to the games they used to put out. Because, you know, the amount of time that these games still took to make, like, even down to, you go further back, like Afterburner and Space Harrier, these are all games that you just pick up and play and quickly put down and Outrun and everything else. So
I think it's what makes Shenmue quite a standout title on Dreamcast as well, because it's such an odd game for a console which was so based on arcade games.
I think it's
that possibly was the way that Sega could have gone, that sort of, that kind of game.
Well, if you look at the current stuff that Sega does put out, like Yakuza, that kind of thing, they have kind of diversified way away from more arcade experiences, I think. You do get a lot of, you know, long-form adventure games like Yakuza, so...
Yeah, absolutely. And while we're slightly brought up Shenmue, before we ask another question, I want to just get Adam to reiterate one thing that he put up in one of his Shenmue videos, which I completely stole and put in one of my Shenmue videos.
Thank you.
But that's his favourite fact about Shenmue. You know what I'm talking about? The money, about how much it costs to make. Everybody said Shenmue was one of the most expensive games ever made, and Adam's about to completely defund that.
Well, okay, so everybody thinks Shenmue cost $70 million because that's what Sega said back in the day. And that rumor is still going around, and it needs to die a horrible death, because it's not true. Yu Suzuki came out a few years ago and said it cost more than, what did he say, 41? It's $41 million. It's like, well, okay, only $41 million. It's like, yes, but that included Shenmue 1, Shenmue 2, the ill-fated Shenmue Saturn, and Virtua Fighter RPG, plus all marketing and publication. So when you break it down to its actual game development budget, it's kind of close to what Shenmue 3 has to work with.
Yeah. While we're talking about the upper echelons of, like, games that, you know, cost a lot of money to make and sold a lot of copies, I think it's... Now's a very nice time to talk a little bit about a game that we all love called Spirit Speed 937.
Who doesn't?
Which is a game.
It's playable. It's next to the Divers.
Yeah,
highly recommend. Screw the Divers. Go play that.
It's not actually playable because it's killed Dreamcast. It was on.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it's killed.
That doesn't surprise me. The thing committed suicide. It was like, I'm out of here.
So Spirit Speed 937, as the name suggests, is a racing game which is set in 937. Where you race old cars, basically. And there's an interesting fact about this game. It was released in Japan. When it was released at retail, it actually sold, was it something like 17 units at retail? That's how many sold in total in Japan, 17. So, yeah. One end of the scale to the other.
Yeah, there's a video in there somewhere. 17 units.
It's something like that, yeah. It's ridiculous.
I thought you were talking, I didn't know that. The other fun fact about it is, I'm sure a lot of you have watched videos and heard of companies like LJN. Probably if anybody watches Angry Video Game Nerd, you've heard of LJN. LJN was bought out by Activision at one point, like back in the early 90s. So Activision actually made Spirit of Speed, and then once they ruined LJN's name completely, you never heard from them again. Until mysteriously 10 years later, Spirit of Speed's got to come out, Activision made it, and they're like, put LJN on it, stamp of crap, and then it's never heard from again. So randomly, that's how you knew it was bad, right there
on the plus side, though, that LJN splash screen is really, really high res. So,
oh, good. That's we have that. So that's made the game like ultra rare, I take it.
Not really. It's just it's legendary because of how bad it is. That's why it's so well regarded.
It's memorable for how bad it is.
Yeah,
it's not mediocre. It's terrible, and you remember it for that reason.
We'll try it. Any other questions?
First, just as a side point, I think when you're talking about putting Dreamcast games in CD players, I think Shenmue actually had some music songs on there that in one of the discs that you could play.
I think you're thinking of the bonus music CD.
I think we've got the bonus music CD in England, but I think one of the other discs had like one kind of a jukebox. They had one.
The jukebox disc was a bonus music CD.
We didn't get that, but I think one of the other discs here.
I think the Passport disc had the option to play the music, but you had to go into the game. It wasn't just like the Dreamcast and CD player played it.
I think one was on the CD.
You could be right.
I have to check again.
Yeah.
My actual question was, it was kind of related to his question. It was about that a lot of arcade hardware was based on Dreamcast stuff, and a lot of those games either haven't been released now or have been released on later consoles. And do you think, one, that it's a shame that the games have been released on like competitor consoles, and it would have changed like the course of, you know, the Dreamcast history if all these great games still have been released on the Dreamcast?
The younger version of me would have been sad. The current version of me is like, it's too, when I want people to play Shenmue, it's way too hard to be like, go get this 20-year-old machine and then get all these other things, you know, to hook it up. Just get the Shenmue re-release, it's easier. Yes, I miss it, but I understand. But in some cases, that doesn't always work out. Like Crazy Taxi, half of the game is destroyed by virtue of the fact that the songs are gone. So, to me, honestly, as long as the port is, or the version is competent, then let people play. That's pretty much my opinion on it.
I think bringing a lot of games that later came out on the Xbox that were originally destined for the Dreamcast, to be honest, I don't think it would have mattered that much if those games had come to the Dreamcast, because the writing was already on the wall for the Dreamcast by the time it was, you know, the plug was pulled, so to speak.
It had a shot, but it would have taken a couple of things like that MP3 player or the ill-fated GTA 3 port.
Yeah.
Or the ill-fated Halo port, which were all in production at one point for Dreamcast. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that alternate universe where those three things happen?
Yeah, oh, well, World of Warcraft on the Dreamcast as well.
Yeah, that's it. Like, it would have been ridiculous.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Or nobody would know what Halo was. It would be this weird, obscure series no one ever heard of. Maybe. You never know.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go. Any other questions, people? No. Okay. Oh, there's one.
So I was going to ask what you think your worst game was without saying Spyro XC, but you already mentioned it now. So is there any games that you think other than that one just kind of like clearly went through somehow but shouldn't really have actually got on the console?
Well, I think I'm going to have to mention the Dreamcast port of Nightmare Creatures 2. It's one of the laziest, the most horrendous ports of a PlayStation 1 game I think I've ever seen. It's really bizarre little curio, because you've even got things like you can change the settings so you can either have it pixelated mess or blurry mess, and I don't understand why. It's an interesting one. Yeah, so Nightmare Creatures 2, I think
for me, Ducati World.
So what's that?
Ducati World. It's a fully licensed Ducati game by ACD, which the same way as made Sydney 2000. And it looks quite good in stills, but then you actually play the game and you can basically drive your motorbike up a wall.
And you can, you know, like in stun run, you can go like that. You can do that on a motorbike in Ducati World. So, yeah,
it's a dreadful game. Also, you can actually stay on the bike for 1 10 minutes before pushing off, which is not 10 seconds even.
It's been a while, but I remember not liking Super Runabout too much when that came out.
Yeah, it's got weird physics and model.
Yeah, it's really weird. And I played it after GTA 3 as well. Yeah.
I think maybe the power version of that actually is meant to be the Dragon, correct me if not, but it's actually meant to be the corrected one, because Japan got one originally.
Right,
that's actually worse than that.
It's probably an unfair answer, but I'd say every single Japanese date sim ever. Because they're obviously completely unplayable if you don't speak Japanese. And the worst part is, if you're like, oh, I'm going to buy every game, you have to get those, and they're expensive, and they suck. So that's what I'm going to go with, because they just make you mad.
And that you're trying to get all those right now?
Oh, I did that 10 years ago.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Anybody else?
I'm right back.
Okay.
I was going to say that. Sorry, I've got a sore throat today, but I just looked at the t-shirt that I'm wearing. I was surprised to hear now you say that Kiss Psycho Circus is one of the worst games on the Dreamcast. Because that probably is the worst Dreamcast game I ever played. Completely. Did you guys ever play it?
Oh, Kiss Psycho Circus. I thought you said Keith's Psycho Circus. Kiss Psycho Circus, yeah, that's an interesting game. It was ported from the PC, I believe, and it's got like sort of snippets of Kiss music.
Oh, snippets.
Yeah, so there's no actual full length song. It's like, you know, you've got 5 seconds of a Kiss song as you walk around in sort of a weird kind of Alice in Wonderland style.
On the PC, it wasn't actually that bad.
Yeah,
it wasn't a good game on the PC, but it wasn't too bad. The problem was the Dreamcast. We had two great first person shooters ported over, and then we seem to have loads and loads of really mediocre ones. So obviously never Half-Life, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think I played it very briefly when it came out, didn't think much of it, and that's the last time I ever touched it.
It's a really odd game, because, I mean, of all the sort of things to base a video game around, the music of a metal band, and then they saw any of the music in the game.
I think it's based on a comic as well.
Oh, is it?
I think it is.
As you say, you've got like all of the games.
Oh, yeah.
So
it doesn't mean I play them all.
No, so I've only recently discovered the fact that they had a lot of these Dreamcast exclusive games that you could only buy through the Sega Japan online service.
Yeah.
So I know Del Lar Jet Set Radio. Do you know what makes that any different?
Oh, that for us, nothing really. Because they got, like I was saying before, Jet Set Radio was like a Japanese release that came out like a year before everybody else got it. Bugs, issues, whatever. Updated it for North America and Europe. Del Lar Jet Set Radio, I believe, is that version plus a couple extra songs.
That was Jet Grind in America.
Jet Grind Radio for us.
Do you know why it's called Jet Grind?
Probably a licensing thing.
No, there's a band called Jet Set Satellite.
That would be a licensing thing.
That had issue with the game called Jet Set Radio. Fair so enough. There you go. That's fans.
And then obviously you had the older kickoffs with the who's the lady that kicked off of that Space Channel 5 as well.
I remember that.
From D-Light.
D-Light, yeah. The Groove is in the Heart. She kicked off. She because she thought the character was based on her. But then in one of the, I think it's the Wii version of Samba de Amigo, you can actually play Groove is in the Heart in the Jet Set Radio. Oh no, sorry, in the Space Channel 5 world while playing Samba de Amigo. It's such a weird little crossover. Do you know any others? So you got like Jet Set Radio.
Growlin, No Tori Kagu, Capital 1-6. Good luck saying that.
Wow.
Do you know what those are?
I forgot what the question was.
Games that came only from Sega Direct. Sega Direct would be kind of like Club Nintendo a little bit, and you could redeem points and send you stuff. So they had this series called Growlin No Tori Kagu, which translates to like birdcage, and it was this like mystery, like FMV kind of adventure where it would just have like actual film video and you would play it. But the problem with that series, other than the fact it was Japanese, so you really couldn't, was that it was online dependent. And those servers didn't last long. And so the first one, I think, got a real release, and then after that, you had to like order in. And so the sixth one came out very much at the very end of the console. It is like the rarest game to find. Yeah. It's really hard. Like, I was actually at, Sega brought me out to Japan earlier this year for Sega Fest, where they announced Shenmue and stuff, and they had this giant thing set up for the Dreamcast 20th anniversary with like every game they could think of. They did not have that one. They had the other five. They did not have the sixth one. I do, but they didn't have it.
And there's another one I can think of, which it's not technically a game, but it's an interesting little curio. It's the so as Adam was saying, Dreamcast that was direct. You could sign up to this thing and become what's called a Dreamcast partner. So it was like a loyalty scheme. And if you buy a Japanese game, if you open it, you've got like a little bit of paper inside. It'll show you like points on a little piece of paper. That's
like Club Nintendo.
Yeah, and if you signed up to this thing, to the Dreamcast Partners service, you would get sent in the post these things, these discs called Dreamcast Express, which was like a demo disc of upcoming releases. And some of those games on those discs are really, really early versions of games that actually came out. So, for example, you've got Buggy Heat. The version of Buggy Heat on the Dreamcast Express demo disc is completely different to the one that actually came out. It's so different. It's actually like, bizarre. The control scheme is completely different. The graphics look different. It's really interesting. A little side note there. So yeah, Dreamcast Express is another one that came direct from Sega.
A lot of those demo discs are really weird too, because like some of them, it's funny mentioned Buggy Heat, because there was another demo. I think it was actually Dream On, the UK magazine specifically, that had a non-playable video demo of the Dreamcast version of Silent Hill 2, which never got released.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. You didn't know that?
No.
Yeah, I'm glad I can help
you with that. But yeah, no, that's a thing. Or maybe it's on the actual Buggy Heat. Buggy Heat and Silent Hill have some sort of connection on the Dreamcast. You wouldn't think so, but it's there.
I know there's also, there's exclusive online games. I know there's Space Channel 5 Part 2 one as well, and that's the one that comes with the Ooh La La alarm clock. So if anyone wants to hit with that one.
I have to rant about that for a second, because when they did that Dreamcast collection for the Xbox 360 with the terrible alternate music for Crazy Taxi, for whatever reason, they put Space Channel 5 Part 2 on that collection.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, guys, that wasn't even released. That doesn't count. Like, you can't put that on the Dreamcast collection, the definitive collection, which, for some reason, Sonic Adventure, like, defective version of Crazy Taxi, Seabass Fishing, Sega Bass, really? And then,
again, that's the point of the Dreamcast, but out of the four games you could have chosen, why was that one of them?
And you know why? Because those had PC ports that were readily available. That's why. And it's like, no.
Sure.
Like that.
Any other questions, guys? Ooh, got a few more hands. So while he walks around, I want to ask you about Shenmue. So you've got Shenmue 1, Shenmue 2, Shenmue 3 is coming out.
I've heard.
What I don't understand is that Yu Suzuki originally said about the fact that there was going to be these, well, he obviously still does, that these are in chapters.
Yes.
So What are the chapters of
one? Shenmue 1 is just Chapter 1. In fact, even the Japanese name of it is Shenmue 1 Yokosuka, Chapter 1 Yokosuka.
And then number 2 is?
Number 2 doesn't exist. Number 2 is a story that takes place between the first game and the second, so when Ryo's on the boat. There, if you play the original Xbox version of Shenmue 2, it came with a digital comic that actually shows you everything that happens.
So Shenmue 3 is Shenmue 2?
No. Shenmue 2 is chapters 3, 4, and 5.
Right.
And then 6 through 17 is unknown. So how much of that will be covered by Shenmue 3?
And that's my worry. No idea. That is my worry, because this isn't the end of Shenmue. I don't know if Shenmue 3
is. It doesn't matter if Shenmue 3 is the most successful, greatest game of all time, or the worst thing ever produced. It sells 8 units. It's still not the end either way.
So, do you think that they're going to be able to get enough buzz together to make Shenmue 4?
I hope so, because that's not going to work twice. Can't pull that rabbit out of the hat again.
Yeah, and that's I think a lot of people realize this is still not the end of the story.
Oh, no, it's not even close. Yu Suzuki originally wanted 7 games, and now his public position is he can get it down to 5, he can push it to 4 if he absolutely has to, but 3, no. So prepare yourself for another cliffhanger, everybody.
Yeah, that might be it then. We may never see the end of Shenmue unless they can do this crazy Kickstarter thing again. So yeah, sorry, your question?
So the Dreamcast was relatively family-friendly console. I remember a couple of hyper-violent games when I was a kid, so Soldier of Fortune was one, where you could dismember people, the guts came out, and I think Sword of the Berserk as well. Can you think of any other violent Dreamcast games?
At the time, Resident Evil would have been considered that. Now it's like really tame, but yeah, that's all I can think of, is the fact that the Resident Evil trilogy, third level, 2, 3, and Code Veronica were put on there. At the time, it was a big deal, but now, not so much.
Code Veronica scared me when I first ever played it. That intro was so amazing.
Dude, yeah, Code Veronica, that game was built for the Dreamcast, like, straight up. And there's a funny story to that one. Like, so Sony had some sort of deal with Capcom to have Resident Evil 3, but Resident Evil 3 was actually meant to be Code Veronica, or what we got as Code Veronica. And Sony's like, you can't have the spin-off game on our competitor. They're like, all right, so they just swapped the names. The spin-off game became Resident Evil 3, and Resident Evil 3 became Code Veronica. There you go.
I'm trying to think of
that's why Code Veronica is so much better.
I can't think of any others, really. I mean, I play Cast and Dead 2, but it's nothing out of the ordinary, is it, really?
Yeah, I mean, by modern standards, not really.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you already played Cast and Dead 1. That wasn't really.
Yeah.
You've got Illbleed's.
Illbleed's cool.
Illbleed, yeah.
Carrier is like a crappy version of Resident Evil.
Yeah. Could you want to explain Illbleed for the people that don't know how Illbleed works? Because it's completely different than any other survival horror.
No, I haven't played it enough.
So Illbleed is a game where you play as a character who is invited into like a sort of fairground that's set up to basically kill you. And if you survive it, you win $10 million or something like that. And so each of the levels are sort of like almost kind of little, what's the word? Like
attractions?
Sorry, the attractions?
Based on horror films.
Yeah, they're kind of based on horror films, and you have to basically survive the night and make out the fairground alive. And
sounds like Saw. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, didn't it have like a very weird mechanic in the sense of like your nervousness meter or something like that? It would go up if you go into certain rooms. You have to like try and step away and basically do nothing just to calm yourself down before you go into the next task.
And yeah,
it had some kind of mechanic.
It's got some like if you've ever played Eternal Darkness on the GameCube, where it's not to that level, but it is if your meter gets too high and you die. So yeah.
Many YouTubers out there wanted to find a good Halloween video to make. Like that's probably quite a good one. It's a really really. Yeah, it's a cool game. I quite like it. Anybody else?
Let's have it all the way down the front.
You look so wound up.
So, when the Dreamcast came out, I was like 10 years old. I'd had the Mega Drive. That was my favourite thing ever. And then I got PlayStation 1. And then, to me, basically, Gran Turismo, Metal Gear Solid, and GTA just had me. Like, that was it. So PS2 was the obvious choice. All my mates had PS2s. I only knew 2 people who had Dreamcast, and I was fortunate enough to play Shenmue, One Crazy Taxi, and a bunch of others. So I was kind of like, redundant to me. I've got a PC, I've got a PS2, I've got pretty much everything. And I wasn't really an arcade gamer because I was too young for that. So what do you think would have made the Dreamcast appeal to me as a 10-year-old that was into like GTA going to, you know.
Since you could play, well,
Dreamcast had GTA 2, and since you could play Metal Gear Solid and Gran Turismo 2 on the Dreamcast through Blinkcast, you should have been there anyway, man.
Yeah.
You could have done it.
I missed out.
You missed out on the best games.
It's all about that third-party support, you know? I mean, like, GTA, that's obviously not a PlayStation PlayStation first-party game. Like, having more third-party support on the Dreamcast was definitely one of its Achilles' heel. Like, back then, no one cares about it now, the fact that you can't get FIFA 99 on it. But back then, that would have been a huge deal. I mean, it still is. Every time a new FIFA game comes out, it's everywhere. You know?
It's Switch. EA doesn't help the Switch. They've only put like two sports games, and
they're really pulling Striker.
But it's interesting you mentioned EA. But I think that would have been a big draw. You know, if there'd been a FIFA game had been on the Dreamcast, that would have been a massive draw. I think with improved graphics over the place.
I just want to let you know, just so you guys know,
football
doesn't have much of an appeal outside. Like FIFA games are really huge here. Just I want you guys to know that. Not a big seller.
But that's the same over here for the Madden game.
I know, and that's terrible. They don't have that sport. So I just want to know, like FIFA, yes, it would help here, but you release it back in the States, it's like...
And sports games are on the back, and so like...
Oh, sports games are huge.
Mega games. They're
not soccer football.
That's why you see all those adverts, all the Madden stuff all in there, whenever you look online, you know, because we just didn't have that. All that or Fred Durst.
For what it's worth, I'm not just saying that because I'm in here, hand egg is way worse than actual football. I just want you guys to know that. I agree with you on that one.
I love it. Actually, not football, but I went out there and went out to the States and I went to a baseball game. It's so different than England. Obviously, it's going to be different sport. I mean, there's like teams sitting next to each other like, hey, you want a beer? It's like, you don't get out of it. Everyone's having a fight. But, yeah. Any other questions?
No. Just circle back to Ryan. No, that's okay. For people who don't know, a lot of third-party developers wouldn't work with Sega, most notably EA, because they got burned by the Sega Saturn. So Sega pretty much did that console by themselves. They had some support, like Ubisoft was in there, and then
Capcom
was by far the biggest third-party supporter. I mean, a lot of games they made, people think Sega made, like Power Stone. Like, the common consensus is, Power Stone 3 by Sega. It's like, no, they had nothing to do with that. But yeah, it's sad.
It would have been great if you had
way more support. What's going on with the mics?
But then, because of that, they actually, you know, Virtua Striker, even me not being a sports fan, that's a good game. You know, the Sega brought their own to it. Look at Virtual Tennis. I mean, that blew up.
Well, and then, of course, the whole 2K line. Sega had this studio they bought called Visual Concepts that went out and made NFL 2K, NBA 2K, all the sports stuff, just to compete with EA. And then as soon as they did that NFL deal back in like 2005 where the NFL signed an exclusivity thing with EA, they immediately sold Visual Concepts to Take-Two, who turned it into 2K, who is now the guys making NBA 2K, WWE, and like Bioshock and stuff.
But that's what I liked about it so much. It was obviously a sports game, people that are fans of sports games would get behind, but they had that Sega flair. Even down to the marketing and the NFL, is it NFL 2K marketing story? Is one of the craziest marketing stories. I did a video on it, so go look it up. But it's about the guy going crazy in his room, and he had to, Sega brought him in for a test run. This is all fake, but it was made to look real. He would go in to test out the new realistic headcam version of NFL 2K, and then he'd go in there and it'd be so realistic he'd actually start tackling people in the street because it was in him, because it was so believable, and they'd done this crazy marketing campaign behind it.
I don't know
if he made it Sega for me.
So I don't remember that commercial, but alright, so
it was an online marketing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did you guys have the commercial line for the Dreamcast where they would like go inside the Dreamcast?
No, that was just
the US? You guys have to look that up on YouTube. It's some of the coolest commercials like ever. Like the whole premise of all these games was like all the characters live inside your Dreamcast and they're partying with each other and stuff. And then when you boot up the game, the right characters like run up, like kind of like Wreck-It Ralph. It was kind of like that. Like they did that in 1999, and those trailers are awesome.
Just off the back of that, I'd like to do some shameless self-promotion. I actually interviewed the guy who came up with that concept for the Dreamcast advertising slogan, the 9999 thing, and
it's thinking,
and all the characters living inside the box. So if you go to the Dreamcast Junkyard, the website, and search for advertising or whatever term you want to use, you'll find an interview with the guy. It's really cool.
Yeah, that's a little bit. It's cool. It's like that Sonic on the decks, and then they're doing a lot of shooting people, and then it's really cool, crazy. It's actually guy walks past. That's really chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. Any other?
Can we get the last question, please?
Last question?
Out of time.
keeps me fit, I'm telling you.
Is there one thing? Have any of you seen the Shenmue movie, and what do you think of it?
It's unwatchable. Yes, I've seen it. So when they brought Shenmue 2 over to the Xbox, they included this. They couldn't bring the first game. It was way too much work to do. So what they did was they just recorded somebody playing Shenmue 1 and then like cut it together as a movie. It's, and I love Shenmue, but that is not a watchable movie. And the weird thing is, that went to theaters in Japan.
Wow.
I can't envision it. It was captured with composite videos, and it's like, ugh. It's just as someone who even loves that, it's boring to watch.
Is it boring just because you're watching someone play a game, or have they just done a bad job?
It's whoever edited it had no sense of film structure. They just like, this is the scene. Like, it doesn't flow like a narrative. It flows like a guy who's doing a really bad Let's Play. And that's how I feel about it. There is a Shenmue 2, the movie. I've never bothered. I'd rather play it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Film structure and video game structure, people think they can work together, but that's really...
I know they did the same on, like, the Kingdom Hearts games and stuff like that. You know, like, some of those, they had to just put the game together into, like, a three-hour movie so you had to play that DS version and stuff like that.
Yeah, I have never seen that particular one, but it's very hard to marry those things. I've done it on my channel, actually. I took... if anybody ever played by Telltale Studios, they did Jurassic Park the game, they did Back to the Future the game. I took those and I cut them together because I have a film background, and I was like, okay, these can actually work. But the problem with a lot of video games is that when you really break it down, a lot of them are like, hey man, you have to move your character over here to get the thing so that you can move it over there to get the thing and then do the thing. So it's a lot of just going around the same environments, which is not an interesting movie. It keeps your mind distracted while you're playing it, but really when you were just to watch it, it's not the most exciting thing. So very few games can marry that. And then on the flip side of that, that's why video game movies almost never work, because they don't have enough story to really make much out of that.
And a lot of directors don't know what they're doing in that sense when they're actually making the movie. And I remember when they made the old Lara Croft movies, the old Tomb Raider movies, not the new one. The guy had never played Tomb Raider in his life, the guy who directed it, and he just got some kid to basically record himself playing Tomb Raider so that he could then somehow make that into a movie. And he goes, oh, I just did it in case she turns into a dragon or something in the end. Like, he had no idea about the series whatsoever.
Yeah. It's worth mentioning the House of the Dead movie by Uwe Boll.
The funniest movie ever made.
They're great because they're so bad. I love them.
That one in particular has this like wave of awful. Like, it'll be good for a second.
Why do you get the good one? Okay. That movie is terrible, and you'll just be like, dude, I'm about ready to turn it on. And then something really weird will happen. You're like, all right, I'm back into this. And then you're like, no, this sucks. Oh, okay. That's that whole movie. And like, you'll get a good laugh. You're like, okay, that was the stupidest thing ever. I'm still going, oh, no, this is awful. Oh, wait, there we go. It just, that whole movie is like that. And then, like, when you get to that party, and everybody's like dancing, and for no reason, there's this giant Sega banner.
I saw that.
Like, Sega would do that? It was probably like to fulfill some requirement.
Right. Wasn't Peter Moore an extra in that film as well? This is a
little surprising.
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah, I don't know.
He played a zombie in the House of the Dead.
Oh, he died in that.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Can we get a big hand for our drink cup?
Thank you.
And later on today, at 2 o'clock, we're going to have Jack Minter.
Okay, so if you're still here right at the end, thank you very much for listening. It was amazing to be on a panel with Adam and also DJ Slope, and also my colleague Mike. It was a really good event, Play Blackpool, and we loved chatting to the audience and basically seeing how many people actually listened to the Dream Pod. It was really cool, and thanks again to the Retro Hour UK. We'll be back with a proper episode in the not too distant future. So thanks for listening.
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.